Welcome back, audience. Welcome back to a couple of returning members of our podcast crew. BB Mike is back again for, I don't know, what, the third, fourth time this season already?
At least.
Something
you can't get
like
rid of me.
That.
I'm here to stay now.
Yeah, well, you know, we could get rid of you. We just choose not to because, okay. You know.
That's true.
Then I'd have to do more work scrounging up, you know, guests to join us.
There you go.
And I believe our buddy Canis Metallicus, the Metal Dog, this is your first time joining us this season, correct?
Most assuredly.
Yeah.
Yay.
Yeah, I was pretty sure on that. So welcome to season 5, longtime stalwart of podcasts, you know, gone by, and welcome back.
Thank you.
We are taking a turn off of the wargaming path here a little bit. We've the last couple of podcasts have been pretty hardcore wargame-ish. And we're going to take a turn off into left field here. We're going to talk some role-playing stuff tonight because I think all three of us, in addition to enjoying some good wargaming, are also fans of a variety of different role-playing things out there. Some of them a little crunchier than others. Some of them a little more combat-specific than others. Some of them a little wackier than others. Some classics of the fantasy genre. I think we've all put in a lot of hours playing good old-fashioned D&D. As well as a variety of other games. Chris, you taught your kid to play. Dragged some friends into that game for a while.
Oh, yeah.
So we've all got, you know, a long history into playing all manner of role-playing games, and we just thought we'd spend an evening chatting about that some. So with that in mind, we're not looking for a lot of comparative philosophy or, hey, how does this game handle this particular circumstance, but rather talking the games we've enjoyed, some of the things we've had fun with over the years, some of the settings we really enjoyed, and some things that we thought were kind of neat about some of those, and you know, some of the favorites that we've had over the years. And so, you know, Metal Dog, while I know you're still trying to put away a little bit of dinner there, we're going to let Mike sort of talk some about some of his favorites before too much of the scotch kicks in and he's starting to. I mean, I guess if you're doing fantasy names, you can't really tell if you're slurring the words, right?
That's true. Even the science fiction ones, that's true.
Yeah.
So there you
Seems
go.
Seems like it. So talk to us, Mike. What are some of the favorite settings in some of the role-playing games that you've had over the years?
So let's back up. Let's go back to 1979, 1980. And so the first RPG game that I bought was D&D, and it was the first boxed basic edition that actually came with the physical dice. It wasn't the little chits that came with the the very first edition.
You had it right. They shipped a bunch of them with dice, and then they ran out of dice because they were selling so many. And so the second round of that edition is what shipped with the chits.
Oh, well, maybe I did get the first edition and didn't even know.
You might well have.
I really wish I still had it.
Is there a crayon in it? Mine came with a crayon in it to color the die.
I was going to say, I can't remember, but I do remember coloring in the number, so maybe it did. Yeah, because you had the D20 that went from 0 to 9, and then it went from 0 to 9 again. You had to color in half of it, yeah.
You had to color them in with different color crayons, huh?
Yeah, you did. And so, yeah, I wish I still had that set. I still had the dice. I don't know why I don't. I think God knows what happened to the actual box set. I don't know if it got thrown out at some point or maybe my mom threw it away. Who knows? But the dice survived. So yeah, I started back in 79 with a basic D&D set. And from that went to Gamma World. And then from that went to Star Trek, the role-playing game. And then there was a big long void. And I didn't really get back into role-playing until even after I got back into, or started wargaming, really. So I want to say I started getting back into looking at role-playing game stuff probably 10 or 15 years ago. So And since then, it's not, you know, back in the day, we'd actually play with people and have groups and actually run sessions. I haven't done that since then. The things I've done, you know, mostly have been solo, surprisingly, right? So yeah, go figure.
Yeah, surprisingly, somehow.
And that could be a whole different podcast of how to do RPG solo. In fact, I'll probably bring up a few other channels where actually there's some good examples of people doing that. Some really good examples, actually. But so yeah, to get back to your original question, though, I guess my favorite topics, was that it?
Well, the settings for some of the games, whether it's the game world or kind of the way the world in which the players are expected to play sort of influences the rules and what you're doing. But not so much, you know, hey, I really like the way the combat system works in this game, and it does better. Like, we're not crunching numbers tonight, right?
Right.
This one's all about the feels.
So setting-wise, there's three main settings, I'm going to say. And I left out Traveler. God strike me down. That was a bad thing to do. I left out the original Traveler, and I still have that box set that I bought back in the day. And we don't want Gary to crawl through the computer and hit us in the head for not mentioning Traveler. But yeah. So there's really three main settings. One is science fiction, and that's, for me, it's mostly Star Trek and Traveler. Those are the two big ones. And then the post-apocalyptic stuff I love. And then fantasy. So I think those are the three main settings that I like.
Kind of genres.
Genres.
With Traveler, were you playing the old Spinward Marches campaign, or was there a different, like a homebrew thing that you built to play within the Traveler stuff?
So
or did you steal stuff from Star Trek?
No. So with Traveler, you know, you got the three black books, and there wasn't a whole lot. There wasn't really any setting at all. I mean, it was just go make your own setting, which we love. And so the people that I was playing with at the time were all into science fiction. And so mainly the harder science fiction stuff, you know, the old classic authors, Asimov and Simic and Heinlein and all those other guys. So we would do, it wasn't really like Star Trek, but we would do kind of more of an exploration type thing with Traveler. I mean, we had like Barlow's Guide to the Extraterrestrials to reference and those kinds of things. And so it was more on like exploring. And then of course you had the trading aspect where you're trying to keep your ship running and all that kind of thing. So, not a whole lot like Star Trek. For that, we had Star Trek, the role-playing game, right?
Pretty much.
So yeah,
pretty much.
And that we ran. And that, so Star Trek, the role-playing game, we would combined with Starfleet battles. So we would do the role-playing stuff, you know, with Star Trek, the role-playing game. And if there was a battle, we'd pull out Starfleet battles and resolve the battles in that. So a session could last quite some time, as you can imagine.
Yeah. And then 6 weeks later, you'd get back to the role-playing game.
Exactly.
So old Metal Dog.
Yeah. Is it my turn?
Sure. Lay it on us.
I get to talk now? Oh, yeah. Sorry. Okay. I actually, surprisingly, am pretty similar to BB Mike in the way that I came up. I got my first D&D. That was my first one. It was 1980. The purple box and Keep on the Borderlands. And it was excellent because at the time, I had just read Lord of the Rings for the first time. And I could see the similarities between the two. So for me, because LOTR is such a influence on me from that day to this, that D&D just really, really hit that groove.
But come on now, Chris. Gary Gygax assured us in a Dragon magazine article in the late 70s that Tolkien was not an influence on D&D.
Yeah, well, I read the back of the first edition DMG, and he had all his influences in there, and there was Fitzleiber and, you know, Howard.
Yeah, the old Appendix N stuff. Yeah, the reason that was in there was he was trying to, you know, avoid any licensing snafus and
I mean, they ended up taking down the old DDG for having Melnibonian and something else in there, too. I think it was...
We can circle back around to that one later. That one has a whole lot more urban legend to it than actual fact with the issue of the Cthulhu and Melnibone stuff in the old Deities and Demigods. Jim Ward has been very vociferous about that online that, like, no, we had permission. The Blooms didn't want to spend the money on the legal fight.
Well, I've actually read some of Jim Ward's stuff over at, Morris World that he's putting stuff up at, and I love the history. It just fires me up because I was there, you know. Yeah. I didn't get the original white box. I was 5 years old in 1975, so sorry, but I came in pretty early. But at the same time, one of the cool things about getting products from TSR at the time was they always had the flyers for all the other stuff, and ended up going into Star Frontier, which I was not a big science fiction fan, but I really dug the aliens that they were Xerians and Drazalite, whatnot. But it was
Drazalites,
really...
I think the Vrusk, weren't those the insects or something like that?
Yeah, I think that you got it right there. And my brother was always my partner in crime because I kind of noogied him into playing with me, and he was just terrible at it and didn't want to have anything to do with it. So thankfully, I ran into a kid who was a couple grades ahead of me, but we were only about 14 months apart. So, and it turns out that he was a DM, and my first games were with him and some friends of ours. So there was three or four of us always. And all of my formative gaming came with him as the DM. We went through, we started with D&D. We did Traveler, which that SOB still has my book.
40 years later, he's still got them.
Yeah. what else did we do? Oh, Battletech, which I absolutely adore. That was great because there was enough role-playing for me to be able to play a character, but being able to do all the math for your mech, you know, tonnage and damage,
yep,
and sinks and all the rest of that stuff. That I'm a math head anyways, so I was
all
like,
the
yeah, this
side
is
of
it.
Things.
Yeah, I love this. This is awesome. And we had the big play mats and, you know, figurines and whatnot. And then he went into the Navy, and I took over our little group for a little while and ran the Steading of the Hill Giant. And by the time we were done doing that, we had lost a couple of people and everybody kind of drifted apart. And then again, as BB Mike said, I bailed for a long time. I had moved out of the town I had grew up in. And where I moved to, we played very sporadically for a couple of years. And then I didn't do anything until, I want to say about 5 years ago, my daughter came to me and said that she had some friends that wanted to learn how to play D&D. And she said, I volunteered you to DM. Oh, thanks, kid. Appreciate that.
Perfect.
So I had to go invest some money into a player's handbook and a DM's guide because we're at fifth edition. And while I'm familiar with the background, I'm not, you know, I don't know what the rules are anymore. And I found fifth edition to be really a really good representation of enough things to keep the players busy creating their characters and striving for something. And the rules were clear enough that I could teach a whole room full of neophytes. I mean, when I was 12, 15, 20 years old, I would have killed to have 10 people in a room with me and playing the game. But now I was the DM for like 10 people. And I was like, what am I doing here? Oh my God, there's so many people. But it was awesome because they were all blank slates. None of them had ever played. So I got to ease into the rule system and ease them into it too. And we all kind of learned together. So, and it was great. I made a really bunch of good friendships out of that. We all still hang out, even though the campaign is suspended for the moment. But if I was going to pick my favorites, the places that I really wanted to play, if I was going to play, it would be my original DM doing a Battletech campaign, and anybody that wants to run a Forgotten Realm. I love Forgotten Realm.
One of the cool things about Battletech that I think we all gravitated to as in high school was when I played a lot, especially when I was living in Germany. One of the cool things that we gravitated to with Battletech is that you're right. You got that individual kind of role playing experience of this is my dude and I can kind of identify with my dude. And there's even in the base board game, not with the Mech Warrior role playing add on, even with the base board game, there is some ability for some advancement and progression as you go through some things, but nobody had to DM, right? You could put 10 dudes around the table and just have a giant mech free for all or split up and play some different sides. But nobody had to be a DM. You could sit there and play the tabletop game and just have some fun with that.
Yeah, just determine turn order and start rolling some dice.
Yeah. Yeah. And so that was one of the cool things about Battletech stuff. Most of my role-playing time growing up, D&D is the 800-pound gorilla in the room, right? It's everywhere. It's ubiquitous. It is the standard against which everything else is measured because that's the one frame of reference that everybody has.
Sure.
But so while that was always the easiest one to find somebody else to play, Battletech as a world always really fascinated me, because that is one of those cases where the rules are very much completely tied into and invested into the game world in which things exist. That's just sort of how it's all built. And BattleTech was in the mid 80s, as they were sort of slowly unveiling the other setting information for BattleTech, that's when the novels started to appear. So then you got the scenario book for the Grey Death Legion as it was written through the series of novels. That's when that's when you started to see the Wolf's Teeth and the Black Widow Company and all those different scenario books come out that didn't just have a whole bunch of game scenarios, but also had the backstory of the different units involved. And so those were cool. Part of what I really dug with BattleTech was I got in on it pretty early as they were just starting to expand the rest of the world with the expansion content that they were releasing for all the games. So MechWarrior came out while I was playing, when the role-playing game came out.
Us too.
Yeah. The Mercenary Handbook, same thing. You know, all those things came out while I was playing. And so the game was expanding as I was playing it, which was kind of cool. It's kind of neat. Part of what inspired the idea of this podcast and part of what has inspired some of the things that I've been doing lately in my own game explorations and game purchases, I picked up on one of the Humble Bundle sales the PDFs of the Designers and Dragons series of books by Shannon Applecline. And Shannon Applecline has been he's been around the role-playing business for a long time. He's worked for a couple of different companies. He did a whole bunch of stuff at RPG.net long, long ago. Really well-connected dude, really smart dude. And I guess about 8 or 10, well, had to be more than 10 years ago now, he had gone to the guys over at Evil Hat Productions and said, hey, what about me writing a history of the role-playing game industry, basically? And Fred Hicks and whoever else over at Evil Hat said, that's a great idea. Get to work. And, you know, I'm sure it was a little more complicated than just that. But this history is really cool the way it's written. What he does is he's got it broken up into decades. So there's the 70s, 80s, 90s, and the aughts, right? Whatever we call the double O's. And in each of those books, he picks the companies that were founded in that decade and carries them forward in that book all the way through until that company either died or we caught up to the present day. So in the 70s, he's got TSR, right? They were the guys that started this whole thing. And so he starts, you know, explaining how the role-playing stuff all started, but then how TSR started, then carries the history of the TSR in the 70s book all the way through the 80s and 90s when WotC bought them. And at that point, you're expected to go pick up in the WotC book in the WotC chapter in the book that it belongs in. So in the 70s, you've got TSR, you've got Flying Buffalo, you've got GDW because of the Traveler, and then, you know,
Judge's Guild
going forward. Judge's Guild is very prominent in there. And so as you carry through each of these, you get to see the evolution, not just of the games, but of the companies. And it's interesting because you can tell there are some people that are obviously good friends of Applecline's or frequent and enthusiastic sources for information for him in these histories, because they make regular appearances throughout the series of books. He constantly comes back to sort of where are these sort of people now as they go through, which is cool. And it's great to be able to sort of follow the careers of some of these people. But then he also talks about some of the more recent things that these people have done, and hey, what about this? And here's this new thing. And then these guys went off and did this other thing. Obviously the White Wolf chapter is a really big deal, because White Wolf changed so many things in the 90s about what everybody else thought about role playing, and so carrying White Wolf forward from there. One of the big challenges reading these books today is that I'm reading the most recently revised version of the books that had things tacked onto them around 2014 or so. So even though they are pretty current, they are still 5-6 years out of date. So I'm wrapping up the book on the aughts right now. And as I'm wrapping up the book on the aughts. There's a lot of companies that are still around, but have changed significantly from what's being described in the chapters that I'm reading. And that's okay. Like, you expect the industry to evolve and change. But going back to like the 70s and 80s books in particular, and reading forward from there, what's crazy about this is the story of my life. Right. I mean, this is literally reading the story. And I'm sure if you guys were reading the books, you'd be feeling the same thing. We lived through this. You know, we're reading about, you know, you're reading about what all happened in TSR in the 80s and the expansion and the boom and the bust and the, you know, the satanic panic of the mid 80s. And then here come these kind of cool games from some other non-role-playing specific publishers. And that was one of the things that Apple Klein points out in there, is that a lot of the early role-playing companies, what we think of as the RPG companies, were not pure RPG companies. They were game companies that did lots of stuff. And this is something that our buddy Cyrano has brought up on a variety of podcasts before, is that all of those early role players, all the people that we think of as the godfathers of role playing, those were all wargamers that sort of drifted into role playing and ended up founding this hobby. But those guys all started as wargamers.
Oh, yeah.
And so you look at, you know, Frank Chadwick's still designing wargames. But Gygax started as a wargamer. You know, these guys all started off doing minis wargaming stuff and then kind of expanded from there. But you look at some of those mid-80s games that we all really kind of loved a bunch. I grew up an army brat. Of course I was going to buy Twilight 2000. You know, that was a role playing game from a war game company, but it's not like that was their first foray into role playing, because GDW had Traveler underneath them also, right?
Was that GDW?
Yeah.
Okay.
But then you see, you know, West End Games is publishing both role playing games and war games. SPI famously made their forays into role playing with Universe and Dragon Quest. Avalon Hill bought the rights to RuneQuest and then completely mucked it all up. You know, the war game companies tried to get involved and didn't do so hot. TSR obviously made all their bones on the role playing games, but it's not like they didn't have any board games out there. Divine Right was a really good game. They had a variety of those micro games that were all pretty good, but even some of the D&D connected tabletop games, there was a Dragonlance module. It was actually a war game. There was an old Mystara module, the Red Arrow Black Shield module, that was actually a war game that tied in. So reading these histories to me was really cool. It really sort of rekindled some interest for me in trying to go find some cool role-playing stuff that I had missed while I was off wargaming along the way, and really made me think, hey, first of all, just reading the old stuff was great, because it was a great trip through stuff that I lived through, and it was a good chance to see behind the curtain of some things I never would have known about when I was 12 and 13 and 14 years old. You know, there's mm-hmm. no way I would have understood the business shenanigans of what was going on. Mm-hmm. But then it was also cool to get into the tens and to see, oh, here's some neat stuff that's coming out or, you know, not that's coming out, but now it's 10 years in the past. Here's some cool stuff that you might have missed, and went and started tracking some of that down. And so, you know, I'll circle back around to talk about some of that a little later in the podcast, but I really think folks like us who have been around role-playing for so long, part of the reason we've just been around role-playing so long is we're old, right? Sorry, guys. Newsflash. Yeah, we're just old. You know, it's physically impossible for a 23-year-old kid to have been around from the beginning of role-playing the way we were. But I really, really enjoyed these books, and I'm so thankful that somebody invested the time to write these things, because they – it was a very enjoyable romp through the history of role playing. So. Mike, what are you playing with these days, if at all? What are you buying to read through? What are you looking at? What are you checking out? I know you said you had picked up the Forbidden Lands box. I've got that one also. What else? Gloomhaven, of course, is, you know, sort of a role playing game with stand ups, but
a little kind of sort of, yeah.
Yeah. What else you got out there?
I think so. You know, you mentioned, you know, that in reading these histories, I'm sure you probably do the same thing that we all do. Is and like Metal Dog said, there's this big void of where I just didn't pay attention to what was going on in the RPG world. So now, you know, drive through RPG, my God, I go in there and look at my library and it's over 900 entries. And so, you know, I'll see they'll have these sales. You can get this old game $1, sometimes free, and I'll just grab them. And so I just to collect all that stuff is just, it's great. Am I getting off topic here, though?
No, you're not. It's a podcast. We're always off topic.
We have no topic, right? What am I looking at now? So I did just get Forbidden Lands, and that's what a beautiful box set that is. I mean, Gary did the unboxing, and it's just these two hardbound books with this beautiful map and these stickers. It's just, I want to get to that one. So I've got that. That's new. It's something called Magic World, and I can't remember exactly why I bought it. And this is a physical copy that I bought of this, of Magic World. I bought the physical copy of D100 Dungeon, and that's an interesting one. And I also bought Ironsworn. Now, D100 Dungeon and Ironsworn are, I guess they're strictly solitaire games. You could probably play those with other people, but I think they're really meant more for solitaire gaming. But those are the newer ones that I have. I'd say those are the newest that I have.
That actually sounds like Choose Your Own Adventures with dice.
It is absolutely nothing like that. There are games out there like that are kind of like that, you know, but this isn't like that at all.
So the old UK Steve Jackson, not the Texas-based Steve Jackson, but the UK-based Steve Jackson had those Fighting Fantasy game books, which were, as you are saying, Metal Dog, they were, you know, Choose Your Own Adventure with dice. And they were fabulous. They were well written, and they were a ton of fun. There were the Fighting Fantasy game books, and there was also the Sorcery series of game books.
Yeah, go ahead.
I was just saying there were four or five of the Sorcery books, plus kind of the spell book system reference document kind of thing. But then of the Fighting Fantasy game books, there were 25 or 30 of these things, easy. And then some board game spinoffs from them also. But then the books themselves, the game books, weren't all just sort of fantasy things in a shared world. There were some space ones. There were some sci-fi things. There were a variety of different ones that were all pretty cool. I enjoyed the hell out of them. I was in Germany when I picked them up at the bookstore on the American base, so it may have been a little easier for us to get them overseas just coming from England rather than having to, you know, hop the Atlantic to get back to the States. So, Mike?
Yeah, I'm not familiar with any of that. It sounds like fun, but I've never heard of any of those.
I'll dig up a couple and send them to you, dude. I've got some laying around here somewhere.
You are good like that.
So, Mike, you mentioned drive-through RPG, how many things you've got stacked up. I just pulled up the app on my computer while we're sitting here talking, and I hit synchronize library, and that was a mistake. I have 84 files left to download.
Yeah, I wouldn't hit synchronize library on mine.
Bear in mind, I keep this thing fairly well synced.
Oh my goodness,
it's crazy. But you know, and there's things in there I probably never read. It's just, but you see them and they're like, oh my God, I didn't even know this existed. I need to check this out one of these days. I'm going to grab it. It's $1,
or it's free.
Yeah, you know, or it's free. Yeah,
that's my weakness. It's free. It's a PDF, so it doesn't take up any physical space. Sure, I'll download it.
Yeah, exactly. That, I mean, why not? Or like you said, idea. you'll see a Humble Bumble or something where they're, you know, hey, you can get these 30 games for $15. Okay, sure. Why not?
Exactly.
So, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm very bad about that. So
I was looking into the, you know, these solo things, and I don't know how much you guys are, you're probably not much into the solo stuff.
Actually interested to hear what you have to say. I was going to ask you what that's like, because when I was a kid, I used to try to do that with D&D, because ultimately I was really the only one I had to play with to do that. So I'm interested to hear how you have gone about doing that or found to do that.
So it's interesting. They have the main, I think the most well-known aid for that sort of thing is the Mythic Game Emulator. And it's kind of, you know, you ask a question, you roll on some tables, and they'll throw out these things to kind of give you ideas. So the stuff you can work with to kind of interpret what's going on in the world. And, it's a little, there's kind of a learning curve there, but once you get to do it, it's really pretty easy. And there's a voice actor named Trevor Duvall, who just came out, I want to say it was like a year ago, maybe not even a year ago. And he has a YouTube channel called Me, Myself, and Die. D-I-E. And go watch this guy. He is amazing. And of course, he you'll never be as good as he is. But he, you know, he's got the voice acting thing. He's using, in his first season, he used the Mythic Oracles, and he used Savage World. And he kind of shows you how to do this and what he's doing. And it's phenomenal. It's like watching a TV show. He's so good. And so you can run these things. The Mythic Emulator is designed to run with just about any RPG system out there.
So he's... I'm sorry, go ahead.
No. It's possible that, you know, you can run a session of just about anything you can think of. But you have to be good at interpreting. You know, you roll on a table that you encounter someone, and it'll give you, say, two words. And it's like, okay, greedy something, a greedy sheriff or something. And you kind of have to interpret that into what your setting is and what's going on. So if you're good at that, you can, it leads to, you know, your adventure kind of builds itself and it can go anywhere.
So you're telling yourself a story? Is that what you're saying to me?
Yeah.
Okay. And they give you just short descriptions and then you tell the story off of those short descriptions.
Yes, exactly. And you know, you can really, it's, and the Mythic Emulator is just one thing. And there's another site on YouTube called Geek Gamers, and it's this, lady that actually also tells you how you can run these things yourself. And she'll tell you, she'll go beyond the Mythic Emulators, and she'll actually bring in other random tables from other RPGs to get the information from, fiction novels. You'll flip to a random page and pull some information out, and that'll be an idea for either an encounter or a setting. It's amazing what you can do.
Well,
and these things work. It's not just for solitaire play. I mean, these things, you can use these things for, if you're an actual dungeon master in a session, say you're having, you know, you get to a point where something's happening you didn't expect, where you pull out the Mythic Emulator and it can kind of help guide you a little bit as to what you might do.
That's outstanding. Cause that was the point I was going to make. It sounds like a dungeon master's best friend.
Yeah, it would be very helpful, I think, for the Dungeon Master. Yeah, I think so.
Thick emulator. I'm going to have to remember that.
Yeah, definitely. Check it out. Now, so Mike, the D100 Dungeon and like Ironsworn, they have their own versions of that built into their systems, I think. Like Ironsworn has its own Oracle, they call it, where it kind of does the same thing. So there's other systems out there now that kind of do the same thing.
So I pulled up my library through DriveThruRPG, and at the moment I have 277 items in it. 277 entries. So some of those are multi-book sets.
Oh, you're slacking. You need to do better than that.
I'm such a... here's the problem. That's just what I have through DriveThruRPG. Like, that doesn't count all the other stuff that I've got sitting around up here. So I'm such...
Well, there's that, too. I'm not even looking at hard copy stuff.
Oh God. No.
Although most of my collection is PDF, I think, though, at this point.
I think at this point I'm probably starting to hit the 50% mark just because I've accumulated so many PDFs. Here's the other thing. That's just the PDFs through DriveThruRPG. That doesn't count PDFs that I've picked up from other places.
Yeah,
whether they were off of Kickstarters or having friends send me stuff that they were working on or whatever else. I mean, that's just coming off of DriveThruRPG. And that's just nuts. That's a lot.
I mean, I'm looking in here, and we talked about Traveler, and it looks like I bought. This must have been one of those Humble Bumble deals where I bought the entire classic Traveler, all those little books they came out with. In addition to the three little black books, you know, they had Mercenary, High Guard, Scouts, and all those other books are in here. So I never had those back in the day, but now I've got them.
Me neither. Oh, that sounds awesome. I loved playing Traveler because I really dug the part about trying to keep your ship going. Because, again, it was my original DM, and he was really good at threading those stories. Now, funnily enough, as I read more books, I found out he was thieving like a mother telling us stories. But it was great because he had a good style. And
why not? Yeah.
Yeah, it was really, really cool. So
I think that's what Traveler was for, yeah.
Yeah, that was one of my favorite ones. So
to steal from one is to plagiarize, and to steal from many is research.
I actually like the creation process and being a DM. I love all those little details, trying to put things together and, you know, making the world fit and unfolding the story for everybody so that they know what it is that's coming down the line. Ah, it's cool.
Yeah. Yeah. I like that too.
I enjoyed a lot of the world building process. I was not a very good DM. I think, as a DM, too many of my Wargamer tendencies would come out, and I was focused too much on sort of the DM versus the player opposition instead of being a cooperative participant in the shared narrative development. And that's just the Wargamer in me. As a player, you can get away with that a little more than you can as a DM. And as a DM, I wasn't very good at it. And I know when you're 14 or 15, you don't have the self-awareness to really realize that you're the problem. You just think that, like, everybody else isn't playing the right kind of game. These guys are screwing with my game. And that wasn't what was happening at all. We just had kind of a clash of styles going on a little bit. And so I've had to sort of come to grips with the fact that I'm just not a good DM, and that's okay. I enjoy playing. I don't enjoy DMing any more than other people enjoy having to suffer through me being a DM. So.
Well, I found that DMing is like anything else in life. The more you do it, the better you get at it. And I found when we wrapped everything up, the last time we played, I had come leaps and bounds from where I was. I was more organized. I had more presentation, more style, more story cohesion, all those things. So I just had a bunch of people, and they all wanted to go up in levels, and I'm not one of those guys that slaps down experience points like they're candy. And the funny thing is the way the system is set up now, they will give you a calculator where you can say, okay, here's your party levels. This is what you do experience level wise for a low encounter, a medium encounter, a high encounter. And then you do the formula, and then you get your monsters, and there you go. But when you're trying to run seven people through a battle, it takes all night. So really, you're just presenting a series of battles with small interludes getting you from the last battle to the next battle. So it was unfortunate that it was that way, but my original point was you get better at it as you do it, and everybody got used to my style and they were looking forward to it when we did it. So
And they
participated, which was the best part. Yeah, I can't tell. I've got all sorts of artists in my little group. I can't tell you all the stuff that they drew. I gave them all folders so that they could keep all their character records and all their stuff together. And man, the stuff they drew on the insides of them folders were awesome.
That's great. That's great when they get that engaged in it. You're right in that the more you do it, the better you get at it. The problem is, all of those early bad iterations, as you are getting better, unfortunately, there's some poor schlub group of players that has to sit through all of those bad sessions while you, as the DM, are trying to improve, right? They're the kids stuck shagging flies in the outfield as you're trying to, you know, figure out how to hit the, you know, get the right launch angle on the bat to hit the home run. And that's, again, at this point in my life, nobody needs me to be a DM. I get, you know, your group needed you to be a DM, so you kind of had to adjust. Nobody needs me to be a DM, and I'm not going to sort of force that level of badness on somebody else if I can help it.
So, hey, I keep waiting for one of them to call me up and go, hey, man, I'm running a game. I want you to come. All right, cool. I'll come heckle your ass then. Let's go.
One of the games that I discovered through the Designers and Dragons book series that I'd never heard of, and I'm sure there's some role-playing person listening that's going, how the hell did you miss that? Well, I missed it because I was off doing wargaming stuff for a good chunk of the time. I missed when the 13th Age book, the 13th Age series of games was released. And the designers were Rob Hinesu and Jonathan Tweet, who were the two primary designers at WotC on 3rd and 4th edition D&D. So after 4th kind of crashed and burned and Rob had left WotC, he joined forces over at Pelgrane Press with Jonathan Tweet, and they released the 13th Age series of books. And I'll tell you, Mike, for as awesome as the Forbidden Lands package is and how well crafted it is, I think I actually like the setting in 13th Age a little better, as I've been reading the both of them sort of in parallel. You know, again, it's not a secret. I work the soccer desk on the weekends at the local indoor soccer place. So I've been taking some of the books with me and thumbing through those when I'm sitting at the desk between things happening there. And I think I actually like the setting on 13th Age a little better. It takes place in a particular empire, but there are a handful of they call them the icons in the book. There are these sort of large mythic personalities that have different kinds of influence over what's going on in the land. And so whether it's some super powerful mystical sorcerer or some super duper bad guy or crime boss kind of thing, what's neat about the way they've constructed the setting and the way the rules are constructed to tie into the setting is that even at very low levels, the players in the party have connections to these icons, whether they've got a familial connection to them or they sort of stumbled into working for one of them, or they've you know, end up getting hired to work for one of them. So the campaign ties you back to these larger than life mythic characters that throughout the game, you're still very tightly tied to the happenings in the world. And the meta campaign gets introduced very early on and builds through. And that was something that I really enjoyed about a lot of the 90s, 80s and 90s role-playing products. And it was something that I hadn't paid that much attention to it across the industry, but reading the Designers and Dragons series, it was sort of called out that the 80s and 90s, the idea of the meta campaign was this really big deal, that the game world evolved through the subsequent supplements that came out. And Shadowrun did that. World of Darkness did that. The old Mystara, the Bechme D&D did that. Forgotten Realms sort of kind of did that with the Avatar series of books. There were these big meta campaigns. BattleTech obviously is the best example of that, right? When the clans come back.
Sure.
That the game worlds weren't static, that they had these evolving stories, and not paying as much attention to the broader trends across the role-playing world. You know, I never really noticed when those things kind of went away, but that's in part because I had drifted away from role-playing a lot by then. The 13th Age book really sort of gives you all the hooks you need for this big meta plot to kind of follow along throughout the game. Now, I haven't picked up any of the 13th Age supplements to see if any of those keep that going. I'd be curious. I just haven't got there yet. I'm still reading the base book. But it's been a ton of fun. It's been a really fascinating thing to read. Yeah. So I was then, and one other note on meta plots, just real quick, is as of the recording of this, and if it's still on sale, I will link it to the podcast when this goes live about 10 days after we record it. But as of right now, the Wrath of the Immortals box set for the Bechme series D&D, which is the big meta plot that ends up with a war amongst the immortals that sinks an entire continent, that whole thing is available for free right now on DriveThruRPG.
Oh, yeah, get out.
I saw that and yeah. I grabbed it, yeah.
Yeah, you can go get it for free on DriveThruRPG right now.
Again, that's why I love DriveThruRPG. It's, and that's why my library is over 900 entries. Yeah. It's like, it's awesome.
It's free. Go get it. You know, and so that's one of those things. You know, if you see it out there and they've got a good deal on it, go grab it, and then you've got it for later when you want it. So, you know, with that bit of monologuing around Metaplot right there, was that something that you guys ever tracked, followed, were all that entertained by, were all that interested in? You know, one of the things that I enjoyed about a lot of the Bechme D&D settings that came out in the late 80s and early 90s when I was very interested in it and had the time to read it was the fact that there was this evolving plot through the Mystara game world, which wasn't even called Mystara when they first launched it in the X1 module. Was that something that you guys ever paid much attention to, ever followed, ever really thought much about? Was it something you just absolutely hated? I mean, Mike, was there ever a meta plot that was something that was a big deal for you?
No, and actually, I think just the opposite. I think it kind of like Metalog said, I kind of skew more towards I want to be the GM and create my own worlds. And I never really got much into the big meta plots or the big preset campaigns that you could set your sessions in. I just never really got into that. No.
I am opposite there because I was deep into TSR and deep into Dungeons and Dragons, and we played a lot of first edition, but X1 was my second module. B2 was my first one. X1 was my second. And from that day to this, I love Bechme. Just, I'll take all of that. I got boatloads of physical copies of, you know, almost 8 or 10 gazetteers. I've got
a couple of almanacs. I've got a couple of the hardcover rules, cyclopedias. Man, I love that stuff. That was excellent. I love
I've got like three or four copies of the rules cyclopedia, the hardcover copies. And because you can buy them in PDF now, it's not as big a deal. But, you know, for a while there, people were like, oh, my God, you've got more than one of these. Because whenever I would see one in a used bookstore, you know, when they're like $4, I'm like, yeah, I'm getting an extra one of those.
Hell yeah.
You know, when they discontinued the line, you didn't know if you were ever going to be able to find them again. So,
yeah. Well, yeah, and so like, but I will buy these things because, like I said, I will rob from these settings. I will take ideas, and if I'm doing a solo session, they're great references to go pull an idea out of or to pull a quest out of or anything. So, they're definitely worth having. Yeah,
you know, Chris, you talk about the all the physical copies of stuff from the old Beckme settings that you have on hand. I'd done that sort of photo archive of all the Mystara stuff that I had, where I was taking pictures of all of my role playing stuff just to get an inventory of it all. But then I had all the Mystara stuff together, and I thought, you know, I could just do a couple of little captions on some of these things and turn it into an article for the website. And then it turned into way more than just a couple of little captions on things. It turned into this sort of deeper
catalog.
Well, not so much a catalog. It was more of it was a more personal thing than that. It was sort of, here's Brant's history with Mystara as he, because I grew up with this. You know, I started playing these things when I was 10, 11 years old. And, you know, Mystara died when I was in my early 20s, you know, after TSR unsuccessfully tried to migrate it to second edition D&D. And then it just fell apart. But I was a very active participant in the old official TSR boards on AOL way back when Bruce Hurd was still a TSR employee and was the moderator on those things. So there was a lot about Mystara that I was heavily involved in.
Damn,
so
you're old.
I had this article.
Sorry, I didn't mean
welcome to the club,
old, man.
Well, so I had this article that I'd written on all these Mystara things and had it up on the website. And it's, what's insane is, you know, I'll go look at some of our site stat traffic, and that is consistently every single month, it is in the top five most trafficked pages on our site. And the crazy thing is, I can't figure out where the traffic's coming from. I have no idea. It's not coming from the Vaults of Pandeus. It's not coming from the Piazza. It's not coming from Dragonfoot. I cannot figure out where this traffic is coming from. Somebody out there is pointing to this Mystara article that I wrote kind of off the cuff for the website. And it's getting a ton of traffic, and I have no idea where it's coming from.
That's awesome.
And it's not like it got a ton just when it went up. It is consistently every month, it is one of the top five most hit pages on our site. It's crazy.
It's because you keep checking the numbers. It's you. You keep adding.
No, because I'm not hitting the page. I'm looking at the analytics chart behind it. I'm not hitting the page. You know, it's not like I'm trying to sell advertising space on the page and I'm trying to artificially inflate our numbers or something. You know, it's just sort of it's kind of there. You know.
No, I believe you. Look, hey, we're all nerds together in this, dude.
There
we
you
all
go.
Got there. We all got there somehow. So, and I'm totally down with your addiction. I love me some Beckme. That was always my favorite, and Forgotten Realms was second. So
yeah.
And nobody cares about Magic the Gathering, but I play a boatload of Arena online, and the scuttlebutt is the next expansion is going to be Forgotten Realms.
Oh, so, wow. Really?
Yeah. Huh. I am so pumped about that. That was always one of the things I disliked about Magic was the fact that they tried to put settings on them and they never seemed to be consistently. They weren't consistent in the little blurbs that they would put on the bottom of the cards. I don't think they really do that much anymore. I think they just explain what the card is. But they used to put all those little flavor texts on the bottom of cards. And so,
some of those were entertaining.
They were. Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And I just wished for a little bit more cohesion in what it was they were trying to sell me when they were doing Ice Ages or they were doing, you know, whatever.
Well, they have gone the other way at this point. Didn't they create the D&D material for one of the Magic settings?
Yeah, Theros. It's a Greek-themed setting, which I'm not against. I love Greek mythology. That's part of how I got to Dungeons & Dragons. So, but yeah, I had heard Forgotten Realms is going to be the next expansion, and I don't care if they put no flavor text on any of it. I'm just going to look at all of it.
I wonder if they're not just trying to recycle all the old artwork that they already own so they don't have to pay artists.
Don't care. I really don't. I just want to look at all that stuff and be, you know, 15 years old again and reading Dragon Magazine and Elminster the Sage and, you know, oh yeah.
Mike, you mentioned some of the solo gaming that you've been doing. I know My Own Worst Enemy has done at least two of the war games from Dark City Games, but have you poked around their programmed adventures, their sort of solo game books?
Yeah, so
in there at all?
I was going to mention that earlier when Metal Dog brought up the choose your own adventure type games. Dark City Games, actually, they're kind of between a choose your own adventure and a role playing game, and they've got these little I forget what they're called.
They're programmed adventures.
And so basically, what you do is you sit down and you. It comes with, I think, a counter sheet, and you actually and you roll up a character. You go through the whole. It's like an RPG, but it's you go through the book, and it kind of based on what you choose in the book, you can encounter these things and succeed or not. So I did buy one when I bought Guadalcanal, but I haven't tried it yet.
So their original shtick was making fantasy trip compatible. Adventures that was the whole thing that they were originally building off of were things that were TFT compatible, because I'd met those guys at Gen Con back in 2007 and I've got a couple of them here somewhere right
now. I did kickstart the fantasy trip. I did do that.
yeah but with those programmed adventures, it's essentially the equivalent of a solo dungeon run through something from the fantasy trip. That's what the rules are based on. They're TFT compatible. I don't know, because of licensing agreements, I don't think they can say it's a TFT game. And I don't know how that, whether or not there was ever an open source version of the TFT rules, like there was with the D20 rules, but that was always their thing, was that they were making stuff that was essentially TFT compatible.
Yeah.
So they are little mini solo TFT adventures. And I, like I said, I got a couple of them here. They were fun. They're not ever going to turn into, oh my God, this is the best time I ever had, but they are a low overhead way to enjoy the game. And it's an easy way to have some fun with it.
Yeah. And I thought about, doing one on My Own Worst Enemy, but then I thought, well, if I do it, then it's going to ruin it for everybody else. Cause once you do it, you don't want to do it again. The solution, why would you want to buy it?
Do one anyway. There's like 12 others they can buy. So don't worry about it. You're only ruining one of them.
I could probably do it and then maybe do a kind of a review or an after action report on it. Yeah. Probably do that.
Write it as a short story and give us the narrative.
There you go.
Something that I'm going to experiment with before too long, now that I've cleared a bunch of stuff off my game table up here. I had talked a while back. Yeah. I put some pictures up online of these kingdom cards that allow you to randomly generate a map using a deck of cards that they're a 5x5 adventure grid that you can sort of hex crawl your way across. And so I've got a stack of all these disparate cards that I had picked up, these disparate decks of cards, whether they're chase cards from Pathfinder stuff or whether they're some Savage Worlds adventure decks or whatever these different cards I've got are. One's a Dungeon Discoveries thing. And so just using all these different decks of cards, I'm going to totally improvise my way through a little adventure. I call them a hex crawl because that's where we all grew up with, even though the actual map itself is a grid, not hexes. So yeah, I'm going to hex crawl my way through this thing and see what happens. And it may turn out completely like crap, but I'm going to try it and see if I have a good time with it.
Yeah.
I don't know that I'm necessarily going to shoot video or write something up on it or anything, because this may be a complete fiasco and I want no evidence of it.
Oh, come on, Brant. Let us all laugh at your failure.
Sure. But along those lines, when I was picking up a couple of things on Amazon back around the Prime Day sales, yes, I bought a dice set. I had to. I didn't have to, but I did. There's this company out there that there's two sets of dice that they make that they come in these little hard box foldable boxes. One of them looks like a treasure chest. The one I bought looks like a mimic as a treasure chest. And then inside comes with the leather dice cup. So you can take the dice cup out, use the box for card storage. And there's five or six full sets of dice in the dice cup, and they're color coded. So if you buy one box of dice, you can give each player like their own color of dice and you know, cover up to like six people. So Lord knows I didn't need dice, right? None of us need dice, but these were kind of cool. The Mimic box was cool. It was on sale. I'm like, all right, I'm buying some more dice. What the hell?
Yeah, those things are like crack.
Oh, the one that I resisted, and I'm still surprised that I managed to hold out and resist. One of the other manufacturers, and you can find this on Amazon, they have the Halfling's Pouch set of dice. It's like 9 or 10 sets of dice in one nice thick cloth bag, but they're all half-sized dice because they're halfling dice.
Oh, God.
So you get cute dice. You don't just get a ton of dice. You get a ton of cute dice.
Mike, have you been to Origins?
Yes. Okay. I met you at Origins.
Damn it. I did, didn't I? Yeah.
How is it that the guy that's been drinking scotch all night remembers this and the guy eating hot dogs doesn't?
Because hot dogs was not the only thing I've had since hot dogs. So.
Yeah.
There you go.
So have you walked the dealer's room with Brant?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, that dude knows how to work a room. He got me a die of the Black Knight. It was a six-sided die, and he started with all six body parts for six, and it counts down to one. It's this great big red die, and it's the Black Knight losing body parts. So, you know, he's just a torso for one, and then, you know, he's got his head and a torso for two, and then all the way through up to six. And every time we play D&D, I always bring that out.
Why would you not?
And everybody looks at that, and they love that thing. They're like, oh, we're going to use this one. Yeah, that's right.
Mike, you know where that one's from?
I know, yeah, I was going to say, I know exactly who you're talking about because I was walked over there too.
Good, excellent.
That's where my Western dice came from.
That's Craig Zipsy. That's Black Oak Workshop. That is the nicest, hardest working dude in the show, in the exhibit hall. Chris, if I'm not mistaken, I think the year that you picked those up, he was working out of the Kenzer and Company booth. He's been in his own booth the last couple of years. But that's Craig from Black Oak Workshop. Makes awesome dice. Some of his big D20s with the dragons on them, those are fantastic dice. The dragon's not so big that it's worth the gimmick on that side. Even without the dragon, the dice would totally be worth it because they're bigger than a normal D20. But man, they feel nice.
Yeah, and he's a nice guy. He's a super nice guy.
And he hooked me up.
Chris, didn't you end up taking the plunge on a bunch of BattleTech dice too, or did you manage to resist that?
No, I stayed away from that. I went to make a desperate buy like Sunday at the end of the day, and they had already left. So.
Oh, okay.
So he would have.
Yeah.
It wasn't trying.
He tried.
I made the mistake of staying for a couple of extra days to see a concert, so I knew I was going to be there, and I had to have something. And I went, crap, it's already gone. So
yeah, one of the craziest stacks of purchases that I managed to make at Origins one year, this was probably 2010, maybe 2011, I think it was 2010, when you know, I had my son with me at Origins that summer, and that, so, you know, he was 7 at the time, but we managed to pick up a whole lot of the old Mage Knight minis with the click bases. Everybody was dumping Mage Knight product because it was, you know, it wasn't cool anymore. It wasn't the hot new thing anymore. So everybody's dumping Mage Knight product and the click base Mech Warrior products. And you could get a box of like 3 or 4 random Mage Knight dudes in there for $1. So you'd go into the booth, here's $10. Give me 10 boxes of random Mage Knight minis because they're pre-painted. So you end up getting an X-Acto knife, sort of shave them off the base, go down to one of the other minis booths there in the exhibit hall and buy a bag of bases for $3-4 and re-glue them all onto there. Now you got a whole bunch of painted minis and you spent $10. Like, you'd spend $10 for a box of the D&D collectible minis that were out at the time. And you know, the quality's not that much different. You just had to do a little bit of work to rebase them. But it was great picking those things up dirt cheap. So I've got a giant box full of pre-painted Mage Knight minis here on the shelf that I still probably ought to, you know, go through one of these days and finish rebasing them all.
And you don't want to be a GM. I don't get it.
I don't want to be a GM. I want to use all those dudes to overrun the GM's horde of kobolds, you know? But it was... It was one of those things that just because of the way the market was trending at the time, everybody was dumping Mage Knight product. And so you could load up on a bunch of those. My very first Origins was 2005, and that was right when the D20 crash was happening, where everybody had all of their D20 compatible stuff, but none of it was selling. And so everybody's just dumping stuff. And I remember the guys from Titan Games, the store up in Michigan, would come down to Origins, and they had these deals, these insane deals of buy one, get three free. So you go over there and you'd plunk down $15 to get one D20 compatible book. And here's three more of them, just because they're trying to unload inventory. They didn't have the space in the warehouse to keep this stuff forever. So they bring it to Origins and just dump it. And that first, and I didn't realize kind of what was going on in the market at the time. I just wanted some cool books to read. And so, you know, there was one that was Forbidden Kingdoms. I got the, there's a Redhurst School of Magic. It's sort of this, you know, genericized Harry Potter kind of magic school thing. Matt Forbeck was actually one of the authors on that. Picked that thing up for like $3. It's a great read. It's a fun book to read. Got it dirt cheap because everybody was just dumping these things. The Spycraft D20 book. It's a fun book to read. Nobody wanted to sell it. So I've got it now. The D20 Modern Military Vehicle Reference Guide. Got it on the shelf. Yeah.
All right, Mike. Now you got to pony up what it is you got hiding on your shelves.
Behind me here? Well, the ones I just mentioned, really. I'm not really at home where I have my usual set, but I've got Dungeon Crawl Classics, Magic World, Forbidden Lands D100, and Star Trek the role-playing game.
The original copy?
That I can see. So this is actually, I own the original copy of that, the first edition. But I don't, they came out with a second edition, and recently, I'd say about a year ago, maybe 2 years ago, I decided, well, I got to have that too and see what the difference is. So yeah, I have both editions of that one.
Love it.
And you still don't know what the differences are.
I do.
Oh, okay.
I do know the differences.
All right, Chris, what's on the shelf there?
Actually, all my stuff is in storage, but if I was going to say anything, it would probably be a couple of Middle-earth role-playing source books. One was Mirkwood, and can't remember what the other one was. And I would say I have a Perfect-bound Stormbringer set.
Oh, wow.
For Elric.
That's cool.
Yeah, I was always a big Elric head. So,
you know, one of the niftiest packaging jobs that I've seen in the last, you know, 10, 15 years was when the Castles and Crusades guys, the Troll Lords guys, came out with the small white box 3-book edition of the basic Castles and Crusades set that was intentionally made to look like the old original white box D&D base game from the early 70s. And they did it back when Gygax was working with the Troll Lords, back before he passed away. The Chenault brothers reached out to Gary Gygax and said, hey, here's what we're doing. We've intentionally built our game around sort of these, the old school kind of rules that you guys had. And we even stole the name of your old wargaming organization for our game. And they struck up a relationship with Gygax working with him, and they started releasing some of his archived material. And I just thought the packaging on that, the packaging design on that was just genius. It was a fantastic little set.
I saw that, and it was outstanding. It was really cool.
Guys, we're kind of coming to the end of our podcast here. In large part, Mike, I know this feels like a really short podcast because we're used to going 2.5 hours these days.
But, and there's so much more we could talk about.
I know. Right? We'll do a volume 2 sometime. It is the guy who's got to edit all this crap back together. I need a break, man. I need one that doesn't go 2.5 hours.
I hear you.
So, Chris, is there any role-playing something that you've always wanted to try and haven't had a chance to yet? Last question of the night. What is something you've always said, man, I really want to give that a whirl and just haven't had a chance to yet?
I tell you what, we took a trip when we first started D&D back with the group I've been playing with. We went to a local shop a couple towns over, and they had a big, I mean, huge box that was a D&D playthrough with, you know, stand-up figures and whatnot. I can't remember the name of it for the life of me. It was like something about Blood Hill, or it was all dark colors. It was, you know, dark yellows and blacks, reds and whatnot.
Dragon's Den.
It could have been,
There was actually two sets that we saw there, and they were both really expensive. The one I'm trying to describe and failing miserably at was about 80, and then the other one we were looking at was 100. And
because there was in the early 90s, there was the D&D black box, the big oversized D&D black box that was the reimplementation of the Beckme rules that was intended to lead you into the rule cyclopedia. And so this was the successor to the old Beckme series of kind of the rainbow boxes, right? The red stick, the dark blue expert, the light blue companion, the black masters, and the gold immortals.
Right.
Got replaced with a big black box that was the intro, but had a giant fold-out map and all the different stand-up dudes. But then not long after that, there were three additional sets that were intended to be companions to those. It was the Dragon's Den, the Goblin's Lair, and the Haunted Tower. That was gold, silver, and light blue in that order. And I'm describing these to you in such great detail because I'm looking at them sitting here on my shelf. That I've got all four of them stacked up together, but all of them had a series of linked, three or four linked adventures in there, had two or three fold-out maps in there, and a whole lot of little punch-out stand-up dudes in each of them.
This was a campaign that you could play with your group, and you could go up through the levels using this whatever was in the box. And it was something that I wanted to introduce them to because it's a lot of younger people. And I thought that it would be better for all of them to have tactile and concrete things to focus on rather than having to tell a story and have them participate. Because honestly, as long as we played, not very good characterization or participation. You know, I love them all, yeah. Every single one of them, but it was basically, okay, what are we doing next, Chris? Come on now, help a brother out here.
Yeah. So. Well, but so these things were, you know, they had the footprint of a Monopoly box, but they're about an inch and a half, 2 inches thick, probably about 2 inches thick.
This thing was probably about 6 inches high and, you know, 10 or 12 deep. So it was a good size box.
Yeah. Yeah.
God, I wish.
No problem. Mike, what's something you've always wanted to give a whirl to and just never really got a chance to do it?
So this is out of left field, but it'd be very hard to do. I've always wanted to either run, well, I guess run would be the thing, is something in a Western setting, but not the Weird West, just a straight up Western. I own Boot Hill and I own Aces and Eights and all these other Western games, but I wouldn't know how to do it. I think that's the most difficult setting, I think, to run a campaign in.
Yeah.
I don't know how you do it without, then that's why there's the Weird West stuff, you know, it's like, okay, you just have like the West. Jonah, what Hex. Do we do?
Do some
so
Jonah.
So really
Hex.
What you want is Red Dead Redemption.
Yeah. Yes, exactly.
Right.
Grand, you know, Theft but Force. Yeah, exactly. Something like that.
I believe there's a Wild West, not a Weird West, but a legit Wild West setting for Savage Worlds. I mean, it's Savage Worlds. I'd be surprised if there wasn't. But
well, there's Deadlands, but that's, you know, again, that's
well,
the Weird
West. That's the Weird West stuff. And I know they did a Deadlands, you know, conversion for Savage Worlds, but I thought there was just a straight up Wild West one. I think amongst the wider industry, I think Aces and Eights has kind of become the standard at this point. I mean, nobody's seen Boot Hill in forever, but I think Aces and Eights is sort of the one these days. The one thing I've always really wanted to give a good run to is I've played a bunch of one-offs, but I've never really played in any sort of extended campaign for Shadowrun. And I think it would be fun to, instead of just a one-off, hey, go do this one thing where, you know, it almost feels like a glorified escape room. I would like to play a more extended campaign of Shadowrun that you've got some time to build some story and some connections and really get into the setting a lot more than you're able to just playing one-shot, one-off kind of things. I think it would be fun to do a good Shadowrun campaign.
I know the exact person to hook you up with.
Yeah, well, but with literally any edition of Shadowrun, like I'm not so beholden to any particular rule set in Shadowrun that it's got to be that one. But just to have a good chance to stretch out in a campaign with that a little bit would be kind of fun.
I would be glad to put the two of you together. You would enjoy one another.
Well, at some point, I got to have some time, too. So, you know, there's always that as an issue.
Well, sure.
So, all right, guys, thank you very much for joining us tonight on a a fun little romp through some role-playing discussion. Again, you know, a little bit of an agenda coming in, but not too much of one, just because there's way too much to cover in a, you know, hour and 10, hour and 20-minute podcast. So, Chris, thank you for joining us. We'll have to bring you back again sometime this season and not make you such a stranger that we don't talk to you all that often anymore.
Oh, my pleasure. Anytime you call, I'll be there.
Sure thing. And, Mike, you've been around too much. Go away.
Nope.
I keep.
Nope. Thanks for the invite again. I like being here, so it's all good.
Good deal. And one of these days, we'll actually get some more role-playing action going, and maybe, you know, when we're allowed to do conventions again, maybe we'll make some time to set aside at Origins to make sure that you guys can get into. Mike, go find your Western role-playing game and go give it a play. Go see what you can do with it. And you know, Metal Dog, we'll find you some more role-playing stuff you can sit down with and just sort of have some fun goofing off with it instead of having to be the dude in charge. So
absolutely.
All right, guys. Audience, thank you very much for joining us on this sort of, you know, misguided romp through some role-playing there. We hope you had a good time, and we'll talk to you all next week on our next episode of Dimension and Dispatches.